Gary Wills has written nearly 40 books on topics ranging from Richard Nixon to the Rosary. He was jailed along with Judy Collins and Joseph Papp during a Vietnam War protest. He has traveled on the campaign trail with a variety of presidential candidates over the past four decades, sailed with William F. Buckley, dined with Hillary Clinton, chewed the fat with Studs Terkel, and yet he has called his new memoir Outside Looking In. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome Gary Wills back to our show. Hi.
Yes, good to be here.
Your title reminds me of all those insiders who are running as outsiders during the current election campaign. In what sense are you an outsider?
Well, I have never joined a campaign staff or a magazine staff or any of the inside things. When I was writing for Esquire, several editors there said, oh, you've got to move to New York or Washington. And Harold Hayes, the editor, said, no, I want you out there in the Midwest. I don't want you to be a know-it-all New Yorker. So I taught for 43 years in universities away from the centers of apparent action. And I liked that distance. It helped me to observe things a little differently, I think.
The fact that you were an academic helped you in your journalistic pursuits?
Yeah, I think it did. I was a kind of academic outsider to journalism and a journalistic outsider to the academy, which made me less a prisoner of the mores of those institutions.
Well, now you're a professor of history emeritus at Northwestern. Are you teaching there?
No, I retired 5 years ago after 25 years teaching there, 18 years of teaching at Hopkins.
You were a bookworm, you say, as a kid. Did that give you a sense of being an observer rather than a participant?
Sure. You are at a reserve, at a distance when you're reading. That's why so few politicians are readers. It's amazing how they lose. Even the ones who began as readers lose it when they become politicians, because unless there's that constant contact and inflow and output of traffic, mental and otherwise, they just don't know. Even somebody like Bill Buckley was not a reader. In fact, one of the reasons he liked to have me around is that he had not read papal encyclicals or about them or about Catholic doctrine. And when he got into fights with Catholics, he knew that I had read those, and so he wanted to draw on that fact.
Well, where did he get all those big words?
He loved big words, even when he didn't know their meaning. It was a game with him. He liked to, for instance, when I wrote somewhere subumbrous as an adjective, he said, what a great word. What does it mean? I said, it means cloaked in shadow. And he said, but I can't find it in any of my dictionaries. And I said, no, I made it up. It's from subumbra in Latin, under the shadow. And he loved that. He loved that kind of thing. But he sometimes would use a big word that he didn't know the meaning of. For instance, he made very popular the use of oxymoron to mean contradiction, which it doesn't. It's a Greek word that means unexpectedly true. Mm-hmm. It's a paradox. It's not a contradiction. It's the very opposite of a contradiction. But he made it so popular that young conservatives all love to use that word now to make them sound like Bill Buckley.
Well, you say that politicians and people like Bill Buckley don't read. Is that why you began asking presidents and presidential candidates what book influenced them the most?
Yes, and most gave really, really expected stock answers. The one who gave me the best answer was Richard Nixon. He's the first one I asked that question. And no one would have expected that he did it, and there were no votes in doing it, but he said Claude Bauer's Life of Albert Beveridge.
What?
And, yeah, totally unexpected. Claude Bowers was a Democratic friend of FDR, and he wrote the life of Albert Beveridge, who was a Republican but admirer of the Federalists in the founding era. He wrote a big four-volume life of John Marshall. And as I talked to Nixon, it made sense. He was at that time running for president, 1968, and he had the Republican idea of being in the arena with Teddy Roosevelt and the Democratic idea of a world of Wilsonian democracy. And both those men were champions of that, so it made perfect sense. And no one would have expected, and no one had put it in his mouth. The only other really good answer, I thought, was Hillary Clinton's. usually when you ask, they pause, they hesitate, they try to think what will impress you, they try to remember if they read a book at all. And with her,
they try to remember whether separation of church and state is in the First Amendment.
That's right. Anyway, Hillary Clinton answered instantly. She said, "The Brothers Karamazov." And I said, "Why?" Mm. And she said, "I read it in high school, and it opened up a whole new view of spirituality that I had never had before." And that was totally convincing and totally profound.
Whereas Bill mostly read mysteries, didn't he?
Yeah. He hesitated. First of all, he said, "What's your favorite?" I said, "No, that's not the game." And then he paused and hesitated, and I figured he's trying to think of something that will impress me, which is what a lot of them do. And finally, I realized that he was doing that, because I had been talking to him before that of working on St. Augustine, an edition of the Confessions. And he said, "The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius." You know, it's as close as he could get to Augustine without. And D.D. Myers, who his press secretary at the time, was sitting in to record these interviews. And her jaw dropped, and she went out and said to the staff, "You'll never believe what he just said is his favorite book."
What did the Bushes, father and son, say?
I didn't ask son, but the father, I asked him. He said, "Well, you know, I don't read much. And now that I'm president, I don't have time. I have to read all these papers." He said, "Of course, I read the classics in prep school, Moby Dick. And the one that really impressed me was Catcher in the Rye." Catcher in the Rye, he was in prep school in the 40s. Catcher in the Rye came out in the 50s after the war. He must have been thinking of a book that impressed his sons when they were in prep school, not when he was in prep school. But then he said, "There's going to be a Democratic convention next week, and I don't want to watch that." And so Barr gave me a book that she just loves and told me I have to read it. But I took it, and I went, "Ugh." And his hands dropped like plummets of lead, because he said, "It's such a big book." And I asked him what it was, and he said, "Bonfire of the Vanities." And when he was elected president, a year or two in, they said, "Are you reading any book?" He said, "Yeah, I'm still reading Bonfire of the Vanities." Never did get through it.
Well, I'm not going to go through all the other people, Dukakis, Carter, unless there was something great there. But it's clear from this book that much of your success has involved making people feel comfortable with you so that they will own up to you whether or not that ultimately proved to be a good choice for them. Did you have any strategies that you employed to do that?
No, I already came equipped temperamentally, because I am rather shy and retiring. My wife says, old ladies and dogs love you because you're so unthreatening. So I started out that way, and I found that because I don't threaten them, they will open up after a while. I was never as good at it as Studs Terkel, but he was different. He was flamboyant, and he would flatter people into being open with him. I was much more retiring, and I often found that books helped. For instance, when I went to write about Jack Ruby's strip club, the drummer in the club was a very smart bodybuilding type who was hired not only as a drummer in the music section, but as a bouncer. He was Mr. Texas. He was a bodybuilder. And Jack Ruby hired him to bounce people out of his club because they tended to get raucous. And his name was Bill Willis. And he said, "But I couldn't get off the stand in time to throw them out because Jack would throw them out first." But anyway, Bill Willis was a playwright, an amateur, but very conscientious playwright. One of his strippers said, "I don't like Bill because he takes liberties." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "He doesn't keep the beat. Instead of doing the bump and grind on the drums, he was thinking about the plays he was writing." Well, he found out that I'd read a lot of plays. We got talking, and he became very close. We became friends and stayed friends for years. And that opened up the other members of the strip club.
To talk to you.
Yeah.
Because if he trusted
Bill's
you.
Friend. Yeah, I was Bill's friend.
Gary Wills is my guest. He has written a memoir called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. It is published by Viking. Well, did this begin in your family? Because your father was a rather compelling personality.
Yeah. He was a very good athlete. He was small, but a very good athlete. boxer, golfer, football player. And he hated the fact that I hated golf and other sports because I was always with a book. When I had to caddy for him, I carried a book in the bag, and when we were held up, I would pull it out. And that really irked him. And finally, he said, I will give you $5 if you'll go a whole week without reading a single thing. And so I said, okay. And
that's a terrible thing for a parent to bribe his kid to do.
No, but my mother, too, thought I read too much. She was afraid I was reading my eyes out. She went to the doctor and said, isn't he hurting his eyes by reading night and day? And he said, no, it's like running night and day. It doesn't hurt your body. Anyway, I took that bet and then bought a book with the $5.
Your revenge. Well, you have all sorts of stories about your father getting on a horse, but that are hilarious here. But your parents divorced, and your father had another family, and then they remarried. Your parents remarried?
My father was very persuasive. He came back and persuaded my mother to remarry him.
It's a Catholic family.
Yeah,
how does that
right.
work?
Well, the priest told her you can't divorce him. He was not actually Catholic at the time. He converted after, but she had put up with a lot of shenanigans for a long time, affairs and things. And finally she said enough, and the priest said, no, a Catholic can't divorce, but she did. She was very devout, but neither of them were book people. She didn't even graduate from high school. And they thought there was something wrong with me because I read so much. But I got a lot of encouragement from the nuns. I had terrific teachers, the Dominican nuns of Adrian, Michigan, and then from the Jesuits in prep school.
Well, you were almost a seminarian.
I was a seminarian for 5.5 years, yes, a Jesuit seminarian.
What happened to your father's other family?
They every now and then get in touch with me, but we're not really close.
Did having been a seminarian help when you went to work for the National Review?
Being a Catholic always helped around Bill.
You point out that a lot of people converted.
Absolutely.
Why?
About a dozen
people. Make him happy?
Well, he was kind of infectious in his enthusiasms, and he did try to bring people into his church. He was a great matchmaker, both religiously and in other ways. He tried to get people together to marry and all that. He liked everybody to be part of his family.
The only ones he couldn't really convince were the disaffected Catholics.
Well, there was only one, Jim Burnham, that he really couldn't bring around. But everybody else, at least a dozen people, became Catholics while they worked for National Review or within his circle.
Now, how did you wind up in that circle? You must have been a conservative at that time, although now you no longer are.
Of a sort. I was in graduate school, and I sent in a piece over the transom about time style, making fun of time style. And Willy Schlamm, who had been close to Henry Luce, loved it and told Bill, you should get this guy to come and write for us. So Bill called me up and asked me to come. It was summer, and I went there, and he said, what are you studying in graduate school? And I said, Greek drama. He said, well, we just lost our drama critic. Why don't you be our drama critic? And I said, no, thanks. I'm going back to graduate school. And he said, well, why don't you hang around for the rest of the summer and do various things for us? So I said, okay. And he said, are you a conservative? And I said, is a distributist a conservative? And he said, oh, alas, no. Philip Burnham had told him that was not the case. Distributism was Chesterton's view, to be neither socialist nor capitalist, to believe in private property, but to believe in a wider distribution of it against monopolies, against capitalistic entrepreneurial, freezing people out. So I didn't have the same enthusiasm for the market that Bill did, but I was a Catholic anti-communist, which is enough to serve. And so we became very good friends, and I was often free in graduate school to go sailing with him when his business buddies couldn't get away. So I sailed with him a lot, and he tried to matchmake me with his sister Maureen, but that didn't work out. So we were very good friends until, especially during the time when he was fighting with Catholics, and he didn't like to sit down and read long encyclicals, so he asked me to do it for him.
And we'll talk about what happened and why a break occurred after we take a little break ourselves.
Sure.
My guest is Gary Wills, and his latest book. This is your, what is this, 41st or something?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to, people count ones with introductions or essays or
contributions to other people's anthologies.
Yeah.
Gary Wills' latest, and this is completely his own, is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer, and it's published by Viking. We'll continue after this. We're back with Gary Wills, who's written any number of books that have been critically acclaimed and also bestsellers, including Lincoln at Gettysburg, What Jesus Meant, and Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. His latest book is a memoir, Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer, published by Viking. Is this your first attempt at writing about yourself?
No, I early on wrote a book called Confessions of a Conservative, in which I tried to explain why I had broken with National Review, because a lot of people ask that. But that was, what, 25 years ago?
Well, you had been very close. You were William F. Buckley's designated biographer, weren't you?
That's right.
So did that involve a lot of research, or was that just simply sitting around and talking with Bill?
No, I interviewed his Yale classmates, his family, many of his enemies, his whole family, various members of his family. I interviewed his music teacher when his father hired a young, brilliant 20-year-old, 20-some-year-old pianist to teach music to all of his children. And when I talked to her, she said it was in some ways the happiest years of my life and in some ways the most destructive. And I said, why? And she said, the Buckley family just sweeps you into their life. And I gave up my own life and found that after some years, my own ambitions as a musician had gone the way of just having fun and games with the Buckleys.
And were you finding the same thing happening with your life?
No. Luckily, I married a very shrewd woman. I was not married to her yet at the time. But I said, you've got to meet Bill. I had just met him. And so we went sailing with him. And when we got off the boat, she said, he's charming, but beware of him. And I said, why? And she said, he absorbs people. And I realized then that that was true.
But he felt betrayed by you, didn't he? Didn't that lead to the break?
I don't know that that was the case. He called me a renegade. But
well, first of all, he told you stories, and then you wrote about them. Did he think that there were things that were off limits, that like his CIA past?
No, there were things that were off limits, and I have never revealed those. But by the time I referred to his CIA past, it had all come out. During the Watergate, it turned out that he worked for Howard Hunt in the CIA down in Mexico. And nothing that I wrote had anything to do with my tapes of things when I was supposedly writing his biography. But apparently he thought so, although we weren't in communication then, because his biographer, John Judas, found that he had written in the margin of a column in which I referred to a CIA service, I think we have to smash him, smash Wills. So he was angry, but I'm not sure how much he thought I was revealing, but I was revealing nothing, and there's plenty that I have not revealed.
Will
it's
you
not,
ever?
It's not, no, it's not degrading to him. He did things to protect friends or family, and he told me that, and I said, I'll keep those confidential. One of the things is, when you enter the CIA, you have to take a lie detector test, and he took it, and he cheated. He told me I lied about, and then he told me what he lied about. It was to protect a member of his family. And I said, how did you get away with it? And he said, apparently if you think you have a right to lie, it won't register as a lie.
On the polygraph test?
Yeah, right. He tricked the polygraph.
He found out that you had sold some of the books that he'd inscribed to you to a used bookstore.
Yeah.
And now this seems to bother a lot of people. Paul Theroux has written about how upset he was when he found out that V.S. Naipaul had sold his books. Inscribed books, and Naipaul's response when he confronted him was, get over it.
Well, I don't know how much it upset Bill. It upset Bill's fans. What happened is I had to move out of my office at the university because I was going part-time at that point. And I had a huge bunch of library there, and I had to take the ones that would fit into my library at home. So I let a used book dealer come in and take whatever he wanted of the ones that were in the university. And then when some of those in his store were sold, Bill's fans bought them and were very angry and sent them to him saying, what an ingrate this. And he sent them to me with no comment. He just sent me what his fans had said. So that was that. Later on, when we got back together, I told him how it had happened, and he understood.
Now, did you find your politics changing?
Sure. I think everybody should.
Was it the Vietnam War?
Mainly that. See, I had very good nuns and priests on things like race, and I had a very close black friend in the seminary. So when I met Bill, I was shocked at the Southern family traditions that he continued. And we argued about that, and John Judas, his biographer, says that I had a lot to do with the fact that he ceased gradually to be a racist. He did not stop criticizing the civil rights movement because he thought Martin Luther King, by criticizing America, was weakening us in our war with communism. Countries around the world saw King saying that America was racist and oppressive and that kind of thing. And that was unpatriotic in Bill's eyes. So he was
very. Even if it was true.
Yeah, sure. So he was very upset that I practically idolized Martin Luther King. But the main thing was Vietnam. Finally, I sent him an article saying there's no conceivable conservative rationale for Vietnam. It's weakening us. It's not weakening the communists. It's destroying our reputation abroad. It's tearing us apart at home. And he said he could not run that because his constituents would not accept it. So that ended our relationship for 30 years.
The same sort of thing might happen today with the new editors of the National Review, if you wrote a similar article about Iraq and Afghanistan.
Perhaps, but the interesting thing is that Bill came out against the Iraq War at the end of his life. That's after we had been reconciled, so I was very happy to see it. But that's not his attitude during the Vietnam War. He was very close to Henry Kissinger, and it very much bothered him that I called Kissinger a war criminal because Kissinger had okayed the use of cluster bombs in civilian areas, which is a war crime.
Now, when you started covering the anti-war protests at places like Berkeley, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and Kent State, you were determined to remain an observer and not a participant. What changed?
That's right. At the 1968 Chicago Convention, my friend Mary Kempton had gone when Dick Gregory invited people to come to his house, which would involve crossing a police line. He went and got arrested, and I was tempted to go, but I figured I'm more useful being an outsider observing. But after a long time, not until 1972, some very enterprising guy called me up and said, we have a different kind of demonstration. It's a legal one. It's petition for redress of grievance. Our lawyers have drawn it up. We have members of Congress are supporting us. So isn't it time you joined a protest, not just wrote about one? So I finally did.
But then you wound up getting arrested, so that was a different kind of protest.
Well, yeah, we jammed the door until Congress stopped funding an undeclared war. And the police came and told us to leave, and there was a big debate the night before what we should do, and Dr. Spock said nonviolent resistance is the best course. So most of us did that, some didn't. And we got arrested, and I spent the night in jail with a friend of mine, Carl Hess, whom I knew from the Institute for Policy Studies. And
he had started off very conservative and over the years became more and more of a, I can't say liberal. He said he never changed, it's just the country that changed.
Well, he was a libertarian when he wrote for Barry Goldwater, and then he became an anarchist. We're in the cell, and he was an autodidact. He never finished college, but he read voraciously and wrote very well, wrote speeches for Gerald Ford and Barry Goldwater and other Republicans. And he said, what's the book? I had with me, and I said, it's a New Testament. I always often carry it. He said, yeah, but why in Greek? And I said, well, learning Greek is the most economical intellectual investment you can make, because whether you're interested in history or politics or oratory or drama or poetry, you're going to have constant references back. If you're in politics, they'll constantly talk about Aristotle's constitutionalism and division of powers. And if you're a philosopher, you run into Plato around every corner and so on with all of the founders of these genres in our culture. So I said it helps to know something about what's constantly being brought up. So we had protested at the House, and a week or two later, we protested at the Senate, again, blocking the door into the Senate until they declared war. And he came over to me when we were scrunching down and said, I want to be in the same cell with you tonight. And I said, how come? He said, I've been studying Greek. I want to go over verb forms. So unfortunately, we got separated at the fingerprinting stage, so we were not in the same cell. But he did study Greek for a while, but he died young, so he didn't go much farther.
Didn't you also get I.F. Stone interested in studying Greek?
No, he was interested in it before I met him. We met at Kent State after the killings there. And he came over to me and knew I taught Greek at Johns Hopkins and said, I'm going to learn Greek when I retire because I want to read Plato in the original. And a lot of people had told me things like that, but they didn't follow through. But when he retired, he did. He studied Greek at American University and with my old teacher, Bernard Knox, and I was a night person then, and he always was, so he'd call me at 2 or 3 in the morning when nobody else was up to ask me, what's this construction, or where do I find aeolic forms for Sappho, or things like that. And he went on, he wrote a book about Plato, so he did follow through. But then one time, we were often at the Institute for Policy Studies, I went up to him and I put out my handshake, and he turned and stalked off. And I said to Mark Raskin, the director of the Institute, what was that? And he said, oh, he's never going to talk to you again because you reviewed the Alger Hiss book that said Hiss was guilty of treason and you agreed with it. And Hiss's lawyer was in the firm of Leonard Boudin, the brother-in-law of I.F. Stone, so Stone was very angry at me. And so then I stopped getting phone calls for a very long time until finally one day at 3 a.m. in the morning, he said, I can't stand it anymore. There's no one can help me right now. So he made one more phone call, but that was the end.
My guest is Gary Wills, who's written a memoir called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. It's published by Viking. It's my sense that you were a lot closer to Hillary Clinton than to Bill. What advice correct me if I'm wrong, but what advice did you give her when she said she wanted to be a better public speaker?
Yeah, we were very friendly and continued while she was in the White House. And one time when we were at lunch, she said, I feel that I'm not really a very good public speaker. And it's true, she had a kind of schoolteacher sing-song. And she said, if you wanted to improve your speaking, what would you do? And I said, I would listen to other people who are good speakers and see if there's something I could pick up from them. And she said, like, who? And I said, well, unfortunately, the best public speakers I've ever heard are black preachers, and you can't do that. You'll be said to be caricaturing them. But I said, Mario Cuomo is a terrific speaker, and if you listen to him, it might help. And so then later on when I saw her, she said, I've been listening to Mario Cuomo. So I think she did improve, whether for that or for lots of other reasons. I presume she was getting help from other people.
You called for Bill Clinton to resign in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. How did she respond to that?
Yeah. Walter Isaacson called me up from Time and said, could you write us something overnight about his admission, the Monica business? And so I did, and I wrote in Time that he should retire, he should resign. And let Al Gore take over because he's going to spend the rest of his term fighting off legal challenges, which, you know, tended to be mainly true. And so I said he should resign. And my wife said, you know, he's supposed to give you a medal in a week, 2 weeks or something. And it's true. The National Endowment for Humanities had given me the medal, and the president has to present it. And so I went to the White House and they come and meet you beforehand, the honorees. And with her, I didn't know how she would take that, so I put my hand out to shake, and she said, "Don't I get a hug?" And she hugged me, and she said, "You're sitting beside me tonight at the dinner table." So obviously she was able to take my recommendation and keep our friendship.
A listener, Michael in Manhattan, asks, what do you consider to be the root cause of the deep ideological division, especially politically, in American society today?
Well,
because you seem to have been, to some degree, able to work on both sides of the political divide.
Yeah, I had good friends on both sides. We congratulated ourselves when Obama was elected that we had transcended our racist past. And the world thought very good things about us, and we thought good things about ourselves. But we were fooling ourselves. We have not transcended our racist past. The Tea Party movement is mainly based in the South, the racist center. And the fact that they can entertain the idea, large numbers of Republicans, that he's not an American, that he's probably a Muslim, that, in fact, he may be a Nazi, a socialist, the Antichrist, the angel of death. Those are not the normal things that you throw at a political opponent. And I think they are covers for what they're really saying, that he's black. You know, their complaints, the deficit, the recession, all that was true under George Bush. That didn't make any of them call him a racist, a communist, a socialist, any of those things.
Coming out and complaining against the deficits that were being created by the wars.
That's right. All of those other things are a cover for the deep racism that we can't get rid of as easily as we had hoped.
Now, they object to that, by the way, the Tea Party.
Of course they do.
Every time anyone says this is really racially motivated, they say this is kind of a smokescreen. The fact of the matter is they're just very unhappy with the way the country is going.
Yeah, they object to that, but when challenged, they didn't kick out all those terrible, terrible signs in the summer of 2000 at those meetings. And reputable congressional people, when asked whether they believe he's an American citizen, say, "Well, I have an open mind," or "I'll see when I look at his birth certificate," or that kind of thing. So they jolly along the extremists in their path. And for them to say either they don't have any extremists or they've renounced the extremists is simply false.
You have met most of the presidents of our lifetime.
Yes.
Any of them going to go down in history as even good presidents?
Well, some are good in one way or another. Nixon was good on lots of things, not only China opening, but a lot of his domestic policies.
But he could be a racist and an anti-Semite.
He was an anti-Semite. He was not so bad on blacks, though. Father Cronin,
the Southern strategy, no?
Oh, that was terrible, yes. Nonetheless, his statements on civil rights were really quite enlightened, mainly because his speechwriter was a priest named Father Cronin, and he was a pioneer for civil rights. And he got along with Nixon and put lots of good speeches into his name. Nixon was very good on promoting the arts, on promoting the family through Moynihan's work. And so he was good in that way and terrible in other ways. And I think that's true of most. I think Carter was very good in some ways. He was, the Camp David Accords, the Panama Canal Treaties, the changed African policy, the civil rights, the human rights campaign abroad. All of those were great. On the other hand, he was narrow and pinched and uninspiring and could not carry the nation along with him. So it's very hard for me to say a president is good or bad.
Well, Ronald Reagan was able to pull the nation along with him. But
that's true.
And there are some people who want to put him up on Mount Rushmore, others who say that he is the beginning of the end.
Well, he had many flaws and many good points. Mises' Justice Department set up the whole of the executive primacy, the signing statements and that kind of thing, the tremendous growth of the executive power, so that the Federalist Society, which was set up under his time, took over the Bush administration, signing statements which are unconstitutional. George Bush did more signing statements, that is, passed a law saying, I'm not going to enforce this or that part of it, than all the presidents who preceded him. And all of that was set up under Reagan and the Mies Justice Department. So you have to sort out the good and the bad, and it's often very difficult.
We've run out of time. Are you working on another book?
I'm writing a book about St. Ambrose of Milan, the bishop who was the most—
Perfect follow-up to this.
Yeah, right. Who was the most powerful man in Italy and, in a way, in the Western Empire.
Gary Wills has written about himself and the people he's known in his latest book. He did not know St. Ambrose of Milan.
No.
This book is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. It's published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us again.
That's great.